To remind all participants, this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the CCI call on the 7th of February, 2012. On the call today, we have Rosemary Sinclair, Cheryl Langdon-Hall, Tobias Mahler, Jonathan Zook, Jonathan Robinson, Olivier Crépin-Leblon of the Adobe, Carlos Aguirre, Monsieur Del Banco. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Paul Redman, and myself, Matthew Peregrin, and we have no noted apology for the call today. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes.
Yes,
thank you, and over to you, Wesley.
Thank you, Natalie. And welcome, everybody. If we go to our agenda, we've got roll call, review, open action items. The only one is on me, and it's around diversity measures. And I'm still waiting on my uni colleagues to come back for this semester. If we could just carry that one over, it may be that I'm not able to report on it until closer to Costa Rica. But whenever I can get the information, I'll bring that to the group. That then takes us, unless there's any comments on other action items or matters in that regard, that would then take us to reviewing the fourth draft of our letter. And I wonder, Barry, would you take us through that? Has everyone seen Natalie's request in the chat about microphones on mute to avoid echoes and background noises and so on?
The echo is actually not a problem now. I was typing back to Natalie. I'm on a headset, so I'm not able to mute. But if it's a problem, someone will have to manually mute me from that end and unmute me every time I want to talk.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks, Barry.
Rosemary, this is Barry. From our last call, I believe we had made it through the measures of consumer trust for the most part, and I'm not sure if we want to just go ahead and spend time on consumer choice and go from there.
I think that is the way to have the meeting, to just go through the last section with all of us. Then we could review those previous sections with people who have joined us today who haven't been able to be with us over the last couple of calls. So that's my suggestion. We go through consumer choice and consumer choice, and then we look at the whole document.
Yep.
Rosemary, it's Steve.
Yes, Steve.
Hey, thank you. I still agree we should dive right into choice, but before we do, we ought to give a chance to see whether you like the new format here. On our last call, we agreed I would take a stab at consolidating the columns for obtaining and reporting so that instead of indicating moderate, difficult, or easy, we actually explain anything other than easy. In other words, we explain whether we anticipate any difficulties, whether they're moderate or severe, with respect to obtaining or reporting. And so I did that. You can see that there's one column instead of two. And if you go back to the consumer trust section for just one moment, you can see how what we had before got mapped into the new form. There's no need to indicate on the first three rows, for instance, about anticipated difficulties. We don't anticipate any. So under the difficulty for survey, I indicated, because we had it as moderate, I indicated the reason we think it's moderate difficult is the challenge to gain consensus on questions, and there's a cost measure.
Yep.
So are you guys on board with that new style of displaying it? Again, the goal was to give the community something to react to, and hopefully community members would pitch in and say, I think I can solve your difficulty there, which they wouldn't have done if all we had was the word difficult or moderate.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, just a quick response from me while others are thinking. Sorry, was that Cheryl?
No.
I really like the new format, Steve, and I was the one who was, you know, very doubtful about whether combining obtainable and reportable would really work. But the way you've done it, I think, is really terrific, and in fact, it's more helpful than what we had before. So I think it's great. Are there any other? Cheryl's got a comment in the chat saying it gets a big tick. Any other thoughts on this new formatting?
Hi, Rosemary. It's Jonathan. I've got my hand up. I thought it was, I mean, I haven't been involved for a while, and it was very useful and easy for me to catch up by reading this document, so compliments on that. And I know I had some offline conversation with Chuck, and he was complimentary about the work that had been done. I've really got a minor pedantic point, and that's in kind of formatting, that some of them are missing the sort of moderate or difficult beforehand. And I think that the very useful format is moderate, colon, and then explanation, and or difficult, colon, and then explanation, otherwise blank. And I think, you know, as long as that's consistent throughout, it's very useful and clear, and it points you very quickly in the right direction. So thanks to you and Steve and the others.
Okay, that's a very useful comment, Jonathan. Thank you. Could I just remind everybody that I've got the mobile version of Adobe Connect, so I never see the hands up. So if someone from the team, Gary or Natalie, or someone else, can just let me know when hands are up, that would be greatly appreciated. Any other comments on that?
This is Steve. I wanted to respond to Jonathan's comment, and I thought about that, Jonathan, as I put this together on Sunday, and there were two columns being consolidated into one. So sometimes it was moderately difficult to obtain, but it was easy to report because we didn't have any aggregation or confidentiality challenges. So I guess we'll have to do more than just moderates, colon. We'd have to say moderately difficult to compile or obtain. And what I found myself doing is I found it was much easier to just simply describe the difficulty and leave it to the reader to understand whether it's truly moderate or severe. And I say that because we hadn't had as much thought and discussion as to what it really meant to be moderate. So I'm happy to add back in something like moderate or severe, but let's do it after we've actually described what the difficulties are, and that will indicate whether it's moderate or not. I don't trust very much our earlier assessments
because
we have changed what the measures are and identified sources we hadn't even anticipated when we first came up with that shorthand of moderate and difficult. Thanks.
Okay, well, why don't we do that? Why don't we now continue to work through the document? And if we want to, we can come back to this issue of just whether and how we could take Jonathan's point forward, which I think is what Jonathan's reflecting is interest in a quick description of the challenges facing us when we go to actually collect and report the data. The explanations are very, very helpful, and perhaps we don't need more than that. But let's come back to that issue after we've worked through, firstly, the area that we didn't work through, which is consumer choice, and then secondly, review the whole document for people who have joined this particular call. Now, back to Barry, I think. Would you mind taking us through, or Steve, would you be happy to take us through the changes here?
This is Steve. I'm happy to do it.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind, that would be terrific.
So we start this page with our definitions. We always repeat the definition of consumer to try to remind people about that. And then we repeated our definition of choice. Range of options available to registrants and users when they want to pick a domain script in a language. And, of course, range of options for choices. It's the proposed purpose of a TLD, like a special purpose TLD. And, of course, the integrity of the domain name registrant, so that if an applicant for a new TLD said, we are going to restrict our new TLD zone so that only chartered banks can be in the .bank, then that conveys some sort of a promise about the purpose and integrity of their zone, the registrants, and consumers then would rely upon that when they would choose where to go on the web, which bank to use, and registrants would rely on that when they decided where to register their bank and build up their brand. I know I always use bank as an example. Somebody should help me with some more examples, but it's such a good one, I can't resist sometimes. Okay, so let's give right now we only have five metrics in here. The first one is Wendy Seltzer's idea, which was that things have to be clear and transparent so that a registrant and a user would be able to make a meaningful distinction about making a choice. Nobody could disagree with that. That's obvious that people can only be empowered to make a choice if they understand what the options are, so it has to be clear and transparent, and the distinctions between a dot bank and a dot finance have to be clear. Again, for a registrant, he makes that decision one time up front, carefully deciding whether to register in dot finance or dot bank. But users don't make that distinction in a big way. They make the distinction a little more casually. They'll get an email from a bank that ends in dot finance or ends in dot com, and they'll make a decision on the snap of the moment as to whether that's a trustworthy URL. My concern here is the source is probably reading the registry proposals and marketing information that accompanies the application, and the difficulty I added was that it's going to be incredibly tough to determine, to define and measure the two nouns here of transparency and clarity. And I wish Wendy was with us to sort of explain a little bit more about that. Does anyone on the call have ideas as to the desirability of this measure and how we solve the problem of defining transparency and clarity?
Cheryl here, Steve.
Well, Cheryl.
Thanks, Cheryl, for the transcript record. I'm all for the it being in there as a metric. I think it is a desirable, highly desirable one. And yeah, I see the difficulty for us to measure the consumer aspects of these choices and have any sort of benchmarking on a measure at 0.0 and a measure at 0.1, 3 and 5. However, that's only because it's not material information that we have within the legacy space beyond people comparing perhaps CCTLD equivalents to GTLD equivalents, and I don't think we should go there. That said, with the WHOIS review team having done a consumer-based survey, a sampling of the end user for their particular purpose, I don't think it would be unreasonable for us to suggest that the review team involved in this activity may find this an ideal ground for exploration of a real touch the edges, obviously third party run, and undoubtedly cost based and probably costly survey, but review teams do have that power, which is out of our ability. So I think that's where we might perhaps footnote them or propose. Thank you.
Cheryl, do you think that the bottom line here is to propose the use of a survey as opposed to a quantitative measure of transparency and clarity?
That is my tendency, because I would like to avoid the next natural situation, which is a comparison between user, end-user perspectives and understanding of purpose and integrity between CCTLD and GTLD, and that's where I think it'll go naturally otherwise.
So, I mean, would you... sorry, this is Jonathan Zook, for the record. I guess my concern with surveys is that without a benchmark at the outset, that you don't know how to make relative comparisons. Because remember, Bruce's original charge for this whole thing was that the program increase consumer trust, choice, and competition. I think it would be difficult to assess whether or not the program brought about an improvement to that on the basis of a survey that said that people either found domain names clear or not clear.
Cheryl here. To respond to that, indeed it would if we were only suggesting it was done in the new GTLD to new GTLD line. The natural suggestion would be it would be a comparison between legacy TLDs and the new GTLDs, which means if you wish to, and if I can was so inclined, it could in fact take a baseline survey of the legacy TLDs now, and if it wanted to, it could even go into the scary line of comparison to CCTLD understanding. That said, there is at least one PhD thesis, and I suspect many more if we want to do a literacy survey, on the understandability, the interpretation, and the supposed integrity. There is no comparison to purpose, proposed purpose, that I am aware of studies, but I'm certainly aware of academic studies that look at exactly this. People have built their doctorates on it. I'll send you a copy of one I've got if you like.
Yeah, except that isn't what's going to happen here. I guess that's the problem. Nobody's going to build a doctorate on it necessarily.
I think we can establish one if we need to. And it also would be relevant if it was the only metric that we were using. It's one of five.
Rosemary here. Now, perhaps the discussion that we've just had could be used to expand the area where we say difficult to define and measure. Perhaps instead of having a footnote, we could take some of those issues and just expand that difficult or the anticipated difficulties column, which at least then records these issues against the measure that's being considered or will be being considered.
Rosemary, this is Jonathan's got his hand up.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. It's Jonathan Robinson speaking. I think for me, as it's currently phrased, I find it hard to see that we could measure that anything other than in a qualitative way, because it talks about the transparency and clarity of the registry benefits and restrictions. Well, that's really hard to measure, which clearly it says there. That said, I could see a way that one might do some kind of, I mean, clearly if there are a set of registry restrictions, at least, one might be able to sample that user base, and that might be either something that the registry does in any event to report on its compliance with its own restrictions, or that could be done by a third party, and on some sort of sampling basis, you take a percentage and check whether they are compliant with the registry restrictions. For example, are they banks, in Steve's example? And I know I know from experience that it's an interesting kind of example of this where you look at not a GTLD, but a TLD in the UK. I mean, Nominet runs .UK. And in the .UK case, there's a perception clearly that these are .UK registrants behind the registrations, but there are no restrictions on the location. And in fact, end users have a high degree of trust and perception of value in names registered in the .UK space. But Nominet might argue that there's some substance behind that, but it's quite hard to... So some of it is about our perception that's very hard to measure. It simply exists when you do a survey of end users, that they think they're in a better place. But certainly to the extent that there were quantitative restrictions like you must be a bank, you must be in the UK, that could be done by quantitative sample-based measurement. Thanks.
Jonathan Robinson, this is Del Bianco. It wouldn't necessarily have to be sampled. If we have in the neighborhood of 1,000 or so TLDs, you can do them all and ask that binary question of whether the registry restrictions were apparent to a potential registrant. And my question for you would be, where would it show up? In the ICANN model, it's registrars that sell us our domain names in the G side. So if I'm looking to register my automated payments company, and I'm considering .bank and .finance, I go to a registrar, and I check the availability of delbianco.finance and delbianco.bank. I don't suppose that the registrars are the place where the potential restrictions are going to be disclosed. Where would they be disclosed? Would the registry itself have its own website? Info.bank.
Well, there's two ways it would work, Steve. There's two ways it would work. I mean, you would either, the registrar would either, I mean, and if one was asking the question, one would make a sample registration and say, in the course of that sample registration, were the restrictions at some point during the registration process clearly and obviously put in front of the prospective registrant by the registrar, or alternatively, was the registrar directed to the registry to see those restrictions? But the normal way it works is the registrar says, by the way, click here to say you've read our terms and conditions, and within the terms and conditions, it is buried the registry's terms and conditions, and the registrant, as we all do with online contracts, simply often ticks to say, yes, I accept the terms and conditions.
So to follow up on that, we could quantitatively dedicate a resource, it would be an ICANN resource, that would visit all of the registrars selling all of the new TLDs, because there's a one-to-many relationship there, and tick the box to say whether the terms and conditions were disclosed to the registrant prior to buying the name, and did those terms and conditions reference the proposed registry restrictions of the TLD?
In a nutshell, yes. And also, one could maybe put a measure on that. Were they very clear, moderately clear, or not clear? You know, something. But yes, in your the simple answer is yes. That could be done, I guess.
And this is different than measuring whether the registry itself is enforcing restrictions. That was above in the consumer trust section.
Yes,
and ICANN has a process for that, the registry restrictions dispute resolution procedure. So here we're only talking about transparency and clarity, not the enforcement of such. So I could expand this space to indicate difficult to define and measure, transparency and clarity. There could be a survey as to the perceived clarity and transparency. And I could also indicate that another potential is to check all registrars selling new TLDs that have registry restrictions and to count the percentage of times that the TNCs include registry restrictions. And the target would be 100%.
Cheryl here on the target.
Go ahead.
I get nervy with 100%. But where we have reduction from previous year measures, why don't we have increase or improvement from previous year measures, which would also push them to have a baseline or previous year, a sub-zero, a sub, you know, a now versus then set of data collection points as well.
I guess the point, Rosemary, is that the target benchmarks aren't necessarily binary, and that, you know, it's you know, bad registry if they don't make it. But I mean, it is the kind of thing where what you would hope for is 100% clarity, and if it was something less than that, that would just indicate an area to work on. I mean, that's the only. I don't know that anything needs to be punished for less than 100%, but it's the kind of thing that.
I understand that, and that's my problem, because if you start putting 100%, like if you do 100% as opposed to 99.99999 uptime on an SLA, then some nitpicker is going to say, it's a failure to comply.
And it would never be on an SLA. I mean, I think it's more a question of...
You know, what I'm saying is...
It's about the goals for the program.
You don't
put on an
SLA.
If part of this expansion is to have special-purpose TLDs, which have registry restrictions in them, strikes me that, gosh, everybody who's considering a TLD ought to see what those restrictions are at the time they're making the decision where to buy a name.
Okay.
Knowing that we never want to say somebody failed, because this isn't a fail-pass test.
Okay. Rosemary,
what's the level of comfort at setting it extremely high, like 100%?
I'm going back to the issues we have in other parts of the telco world, where then you start splitting hairs on the individual's ability to actually make a distinction on what the purpose actually meant, what their assumptions were on the integrity. I'm happy to go with, you know, a fraction under 100, but as soon as you say 100, you sort of leave, it becomes a pass-fail, perhaps without any consequences other than reputation, but it leaves a wriggle room for interpretation, is the only word I can come up with at this hour of the morning without coffee, of the person. It's like people who, but I didn't read the contract. There'll always be, I might have been shown that document, but I had a migraine and no glasses that day, so I didn't read it. You've just got to, you know, make sure those don't spoil the soup.
Yes. Well, Rosemary here, I think the point that Cheryl is making is that in our measure, we're combining two things. We're combining transparency and clarity from the registry with decisions made by users. And where I come down is that I think we could have a target that all registry processes offer transparency and clarity to users, but the tricky ground that we can't get into, as I think Cheryl's highlighting
yep.
for us, is we can't have a measure that says 100% of users must make meaningful decisions, distinctions and choices, because that, of course, is something we can't control, even if 100% of our registrars has been very transparent and clear about the registry benefits. Did I capture that, Cheryl?
Yes, you did.
Rosemary, this is Steve. I believe that Jonathan Robinson and I were not indicating clarity. We were not conflating clarity with transparency in this audit. We were attempting to be quantitative, to have a binary determination about whether the registrar even showed the terms and conditions of the underlying TLD. And
yes.
It's a little bit more difficult to measure, was it clear to an average reader? I'm much less comfortable with clarity, but I do believe we could have a binary on-off. Did every registrar selling .bank clearly disclose the terms and conditions that were passed along to them from the registry? Could be determined, and I can't understand a world where that number could be anywhere less than 100%. And you might also apply it to the registries, because before I went to GoDaddy to get my .bank,
yes.
assuming they're allowed to carry it, probably would go to some sort of a website that .bank has up where they describe what the terms and conditions are about .bank. There's not a, I don't know for sure, but does the guidebook require that every TLD operator have a general information website? Anybody know the answer? Barry, that would be a good one for you to help us on.
Yes.
Cheryl here, Steve and Rosemary.
Yes, Cheryl.
Steve, I see where you are on that specific binary, and I'm happy for that to be in 100%, but then we need to untether what I think part of Wendy's original construct of this metric is, and that is the consumer understanding of, right? Remember,
yeah.
you're going to just, and that can't be 100%, so maybe we need to split it into two, because all you need, it gets us back to, admittedly, this is a more close to compliance, but it gets us back to the situation of everyone in some situations is given a end-user contract, and the reading of that is way, way, way under 100%. So you don't, yes, having it accessible, available and presented can be a binary, but to measure the consumer, the end user, being able to trust on that metric is a little trickier, and that's where I get uncomfortable if we're aiming for 100.
Yeah, so you're making a great case to split this, Cheryl, into two, one line on the transparency.
Yeah.
Restrictions, both from the registries and registrars, each of whom would have 100%,
yep.
and then a separate line for clarity and understanding on the part of end users
that,
of the potential school registry restrictions, and that would be survey based or some other thing.
That's that I'm comfortable with. Yep.
Yeah, and then
Barry's chat indicates he's checking on whether the guidebook requires a registry operator to have a site someplace. And if, Barry, if you can find that, then we would probably make that a requirement that that be 100%, that any restrictions be contained on a general purpose website for the registry operator. And if there is no such requirement in the guidebook, we might still have a row indicating that. The people have to be able to know before they make the decision to bet their brand on a TLD, they've got to know what the restrictions are, what the proposed policies are, the long-term pricing, renewal terms, and things like that.
Yep.
And I don't see any hands up. Anyone else want to get in on this first measure? And Jonathan Robinson has agreed to the split. Cheryl's going to go feed the birds. And just kidding. So I will probably split this into two rows and follow the recommendations we just talked about. No further comments. You want to go to the next one? The quantity and relative incidence of new registrants versus existing registrants. It's an indication of choice. Try to understand if the GTLD expansion was so inviting to first-time registrants that for the first time they decided, I didn't have what I wanted in COM. I love this expansion, and I feel I love it that I can finally get a dot music, a dot gay, one that's for me. Or I'm a financial institution and I want dot finance or dot loan. So I don't know what the target would be, but we've made a promise to the planet that this expansion will bring new people in. And it can't just be new contract parties. Somewhere along the line, we think new registrants will come in. So what's the thinking about whether we can keep a measure in here? Let's look at the desirability of this measure first, and then we'll get to the difficulties in obtaining and reporting.
Well, this is Jonathan, so I think that measure is essential. It's going to have the underpinning rationale for the program itself. That's how we'll know that it created new opportunities or expansion rather than just defensive registrations.
And some portion of the registrations will be people that say, I've been living in .NET, and I don't love it. It doesn't really suit me. And when .gay came out, I jumped there. So I wouldn't show up in the new column, but I certainly did benefit from the choice.
Yeah.
That just argues that our measure will be imprecise, and it won't truly measure choice, but it gets partway there. I mean, for what Jonathan Zook said. So I wouldn't set this goal very high.
Hi, it's Jonathan Robinson. One thought I have here is that clearly it's very hard to identify individual registrants, even simply on the basis of the fact that the data will be dirty. You know, one registrant registering in two TLDs might appear different, even if it was the same person. But my idea that's ill-formed is just thinking about the national origin. Most registrants give the country of origin. And if we saw a significant change in the national origin of registrants, that might be a way of measuring, you know, whether it had brought new users in from new parts of the world or even existing parts. That might be a way where one could do quite big surveys by simply looking at that field, the country of origin. I need to think it through whether that's both practical and whether it would produce the answer, and maybe someone else can pick up the baton there. But that's just an idea that I'm thinking of to make it practical. Thanks.
If I understand you properly, Jonathan R., you were indicating that rather than measure, or sorry, maybe in addition to measuring whether somebody already had a domain name, you would want to measure what part of the world they are from and aggregate those statistics.
That's right. I'm thinking it's very, very difficult to measure whether somebody had a domain name or not. You know, I register jonathanrobinson.bank, and how on earth do you know whether I had jonathanrobinson.com or anything else? I mean, that's a pretty difficult task because I might have registered them from completely different addresses. But one way, you know, if there may be a higher level at which one could measure the data, or a simpler level by simply looking at something like country of origin.
Any other comments on this measure? What would be a potential target? Because, again, our goal is to get this document well enough constructed that we can publish it for public comment and not look like a bunch of crazies who hadn't thought it through. So let's be sure that we put our best words on paper so that we can answer questions and criticism from the broader community.
Someone else wanting to make a comment?
Yeah, this is Paul Redman. If you're splitting the one we just talked about earlier in two, what's the difference between the latter half, registrants and users make meaningful distinctions and informed choices, versus this one, the quantity and relative incidence of new registrants?
Paul, I can answer that. The first one on transparency and clarity is strictly a measure of the display. The display and understanding that's available from what's published when one makes the decision to register a name. The second row, the row on quantity and relative incidence, is to measure after the fact of those who registered names in the new TLDs. We don't even care whether that was clear to them or whether they understood it. We simply want to know, were they new? Were they first-time registrants? Have they ever registered this name before in another TLD? If Jonathan Robinson was in .com, JonathanRobinsonBank.com, and he decides to jump into JonathanRobinson.bank, hard to say that's a defensive registration.
It
may well be somebody exercising a choice. And if he's a new registrant, it's certainly a choice they made, because they made a choice to register a domain name where they hadn't registered one before. Now, I know that when people register names, there's not a yes-no indicator to say, is this your first domain name? So I don't think we're going to be able to gather that at registration time. Are there surveys one can do after the fact? Hard to do as well, because people change their preferences over time.
And purpose.
That's right. And, well, if a registry changes its purpose, that's a big deal, Cheryl.
No.
They've got to get approval to do that.
Registrant changed their purpose. Yeah.
Okay, got it. The registrant. Now, the row after this, it gets a little bit to what Jonathan Zook mentioned earlier on the call with respect to defensive registrations. We would do the community a great service if we could design a quantitative way of measuring defensive registrations. That will be a buzzword used over and over again, not only at ICANN, but maybe even some courts, because a lot of brand owners are very concerned that the cost of defensive registrations will be the entire financial model for many of the new top-level domains. And there'll
Steve,
be a thousand whether a registration was defensive or was it done to get new traffic.
Steve, it's Jonathan Robinson. When I saw this point, I thought maybe this one stays, and there's an additional option here, or perhaps it could be replaced with this additional one. But it strikes me that really the test here is the percentage of Sunrise of domain names registered during Sunrise relative to the overall size of the registry after 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years, or something like that. It's really what proportion of this registry is driven by Sunrise registrations. And in fact, that could be relatively easy to measure retrospectively, I think, against existing operating registries or recently launched registries as well. Is it, you know, 20%, 25%, 30%, 10% at the year, and clearly at the end of Sunrise, it's 100%. But it's the question to which the extent to which the registry then goes on to successfully market to domain name applicants or registrants beyond Sunrise after year one, year two, and year three. So that strikes me as a key measure.
That's beautiful. I like it.
Well, I think that's a great – this is Jonathan Zook. I think that's a great measure. I think we still probably, even in year two through four, need to measure
whether it's an original site, just so we have data. I mean, nothing's going to be a perfect measure, but or if it's just a pointer, you know, forward to an existing, to a previously existing site. Because not everybody's going to make their defensive registrations during the sunrise period. Those are all going to be fairly sophisticated registrants that do that, that make use of that sunrise period. And I think others are going to find that over time that they may or may not need to register their name additionally to prevent you know, end-user confusion and phishing and things of that sort. So I mean, the sunrise, it can't be the sole criteria for defensive registration, but it's certainly a very valuable one.
This is Steve. So as the scribe, what I captured there is Robinson's innovation here is that you measure the relative share of sunrise registrations to total registrations, and you measure it in years 1, 2, and at the end of years 1, 2, and 3, it should go down a lot, indicating that the zone had broader appeal than just defensive registrations. I think we want to capture that thought as a standalone row.
Yep.
Yes.
And then Jonathan Zook's idea is an excellent one, is that the very next row should indicate that we are questing for a broader measure of defensive registration, beyond that which is recorded during a 30-day sunrise period. There may well be a lot of brand owners who believe what Peter Dengate Thrush and everyone has been saying, that there won't be a lot of defensive registrations needed, and so they didn't bother jumping into the sunrise. Oh, but then 6 months into it, a lot of squatting activity leads them to jump in and do a bunch of defensive registrations. And without Jonathan Zook's point, we would miss that. So we need to We need to describe the fact that not only did this working group recognize that data deficiency, but then we have posed perhaps some way. The third row in this table, I indicated some potential way of measuring it was whether a registrant already had the same domain in a legacy TLD. And that would be done through an audit, where you go 3 years out. These are three-year-out targets. So third year out, you measure all of the registrants in a given TLD or a sample of TLDs, and then you have to look back at some snapshot of 2011, see whether that exact same left-of-the-dot domain name already existed in the legacy TLDs. Does that statistic begin to get to what you're after, Jonathan?
I think it certainly gets to it. I mean, it's the crunch way of doing it, and I think it definitely gets to that point. What I was trying to think of is that there's probably an automated way to do a page request, HTTP or HTTPS page request, and gain an understanding from that whether or not there was a redirect. And at least capture that statistic. Again, it won't be perfect. There's different reasons for redirects.
Mm.
But if they register a domain just to use as a redirect to an existing domain, that feels like something worth measuring. Whether or not we call that all 100% defensive is another question. But it certainly feels as though there wasn't some innovation that came as a result. There wasn't some new face. I mean, because even if I have the same domain under, same second level under different first levels, I presumably create two facades to my business or something like that, or portals into it. Because I'm a photographer, I might get jonathanzook.photo in addition to jonathanzook.com. But I think that if I register a domain for the sole purpose of redirecting it to an existing one, that will be interesting information to have in the context of a review.
It's a great point, Jonathan, but you still might redirect jonathanzook.photo. You might even still redirect it to .com and enjoy the traffic and branding you got in .photo.
And that's why I believe it's an imperfect measure, but I still believe that it will be valuable data to have tracked.
Okay.
That it's something worth measuring and then decide later how that, the value to place on that information. But I think the likelihood that unless a particular domain is incredibly well managed and promoted as a kind of a shopping mall or something like that,
you know, the likelihood of buying something just for the traffic that it gets me seems less likely than feeling the need to just cover my bases in that domain. I mean, there might be domains that are purchased that don't go anywhere, and that's an interesting measure as well. I don't know.
So what I captured there is the after we said that sunrise alone can't be the sole measure of defensive registrations, since there will be post-sunrise defenses, we have two potentials. One is auditing, an automated audit, where you walk the zones, either all of them or a sample, and look for redirects. And redirects as a percentage of those that just go to a name server. A second is to audit against the snapshot of the 2011 legacy GTLDs, which will get you a 2- and 3-year snapshot of what changed. And Barry Cobb, do you know whether we take snapshots of the zones at the end of calendar years, or can that be something we can arrange for?
This is Barry. I don't have any knowledge of that kind of activity taking place, at least not within ICANN, but I can't imagine that it would be difficult to do.
And Barry, you put an item in the chat. If it's not relevant to this row, I'll wait till we just finish discussing this row and come back to you.
Sure. And Olivier has his hand raised as well.
Go ahead, Olivier.
Thanks very much, Steve. It's Olivia for the transcript. I've followed the discussion that we've just had now with great interest, and I agree, I think, with most of the measures which are being made for the defensive registrations. I think the quantity and relative incidence of new registrants versus existing registrants is a lot tougher to crack. And certainly... the discussions which I've seen here haven't seemed to have found any kind of serious answer to this. I just wondered whether there had been any kind of audit as to how many actual individual registrants there are at the moment with regards to the total number of domain names that are registered. Because if that measure has not been done due to the difficulty of it, I don't see how we could then do a measure of determining whether registrants already had domains in legacy GTLDs before. So is there such a thing? Is it possible to do one?
Barry, any insights on that?
This is Barry. I definitely have to agree with Olivier. That's a very difficult one. I mean, we can all agree that it's going to be, you know, if you were to do an average number of domains per registrant, it's going to be greater than one. But to come down with a total number of registrants, given the privacy and proxy services, the dirtiness of the existing WHOIS data, that would be a tough one. But I'm not going to say it's impossible.
Now, if I can follow up on this, Cheryl, maybe I'll let you speak, and then if I can follow up after that.
Only on that specific point of Barry's, if you don't mind, thank you, Olivia, Cheryl, for the transcript record. Yes, I see the challenges and the difficulties, but I also see a possibility of where a targeted survey or sampling method could extract some cleaned, in other words, non-attributable data. Through a third-party analysis, and that would be to look at where there are portfolios held by various registrars. Admittedly, that wouldn't pick up... by portfolios, I mean registrant portfolios. That wouldn't pick up registrations of names, not TLDs, registrations of names, in those places where there is pure vertical integration, I admit, but where there is not, for example, the company I get all my names through, whichever company that is, by the end of 12 months, I've moved what I would consider my registrant name portfolio, and that would give on a simple my customer code number search, in other words, not attributable to my name or my privacy or what, even what country I'm in, if it's one that isn't located in Australia, for example, you would be able to get from that person, from that company, I should say, how many names in how many sectors of how many sorts I had. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in the world who does that. Thank you.
Olivier?
Thank you, Steve. And I think that might be one solution. The other thing I just wanted to say was, because the difficulty is there, I don't think we should pass over this. I think the metric itself is important enough to have some data rather than no data whatsoever. So I would strongly encourage this to be kept.
Got it. And let me just try to clarify, since I'm trying to capture this for the first time in the draft. You're suggesting that a ratio of names per registrant, which is the total number of names divided by the total number of unique registrants, is a meaningful statistic. And I wanted you to explain again why it's meaningful, and then what should you expect it to be over time in the new space, if as an indication that consumer choice has gotten better.
Okay, thanks, Steve. It's Olivier for the transcript. I believe the metric itself is important because ICANN has been marketing the new GTLD process as being a means to expand the domain namespace by providing names for everyone. And a large significance of ICANN's marketing campaign has been to say new registrants coming onto the internet do not have the space to register their domains because of the overcrowdedness of the current GTLD space. If this metric is not undertaken, there is no way to find out if we've actually reached new registrants or whether we've actually just serviced existing registrants.
Is it too late? This is Jonathan.
Olivier, this is Steve. I mean, if we needed to just measure new, we can use something we discussed earlier, which is auditing against the 2011 snapshot of domain names that were present in 2011 in the legacy TLDs. That might be a more direct measure of new. You're getting at this notion of how many names does a given person own, and you're thinking that over time, if we get new people that only own one name, that number would be driven down. But help me understand philosophically why that is an indication of improved consumer choice.
Okay, I think we're talking across each other there because I'm looking at measuring how many of the registrants are new registrants, not how many hold single registrations. So I'm trying to find exactly what it says in the box, quantity and relative incidence of new registrants versus existing registrants.
Hmm. Do you like to ask registrants to just ask that question when they register a domain in a new TLD?
Right, an indication where they check a box to say whether this is your first domain name registration.
It's Olivia here, and I thought that probably would be the easiest thing to do.
Easiest thing to do, hardest thing to get the registrars to do, right?
Right. I mean, it might end up needing to be a contract change to do it. I mean, that's the difficulty.
That will only take about 4 years. Is when something like this comes up, if it's very difficult to get universal compliance, we usually turn to surveys. While they're expensive, a survey is the kind of thing that you can go in at the end of year one and do an automated survey of all registrants in the new TLD spaces and ask, was this your first registration? Want to consider something like that as another way to get to the answer. Thank you.
Yep.
It's probably worth doing to get some kind of number. And we'll just have some kind of error coefficient associated with it, but it's probably worth doing.
Do the team feel that that survey, while it's expensive, is more realistic than forcing every registrar to ask the question on their screen?
Oh, money well spent. because people won't, and then if it's not compulsory or mandatory, it's, no, money well spent if you want meaningful results.
Rosemary here, Steve. I think given the, you know, the magnitude of this initiative to do that kind of survey at the end of the first year would be a very good course of action. And it really goes to ICANN's seriousness of purpose in understanding the impact of this program.
So the survey would say at the end of the first year, we would do an automated walk of the new zones, some sample. There'd be an email or phone call, depending on what was necessary for the survey to get a high response rate. And it would try to discern whether the registrant was a new name and whether the registrant had ever registered any names before. You'd get to the sense as to whether the name were new and whether the registrant made this the first time they put the toe in the water of being a registrant.
Yes.
Olivier, do you feel like this is a satisfactory way to get to what you were suggesting earlier?
Thanks, Steve. It's Olivier for the transcript. Yes, it's better than nothing, put it this way. So I have a smile here on my face.
Great. And we have not talked about the final column on there, which is the targets, the three-year target. And it was the board who said I wanted three-year targets to be aspirational. Sometimes our targets are relative improvements over time. Sometimes they're fixed percentages, and sometimes they're comparative statistics, where you compare it to the legacy TLDs. What are the right statistics that we should be using for three-year targets on these?
Steve? Olivier here.
Sorry. Yep.
Oh, sorry, Rosemary. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Olivia. Rosemary, for the record. I was just thinking that it's very, very difficult for us to put any number on this. But I would think that philosophically we'd be looking for growth over 3 years in this area.
Yeah, relative targets, yeah.
Yes, thank you. Olivia,
Yes, thank you, Rosemary. Did I hear you said growth over 3 years?
Yes, in terms of the new registrant.
Okay, so I think okay, for the percentage of new registrants, I would totally agree with you. For the percentage of defensive registrations, I would hope that we don't have growth over years. But at the same time, I totally agree with you that it would be very difficult for us to think of any arbitrary number at this position. So I leave this open-ended. As low as possible for the percentage of defensive registrations, and as high as, well, you can't even say as high as possible, because ultimately the success of the program is not going to be on the relative incidence of new registrants, because you might get a lot of new registrants in the first year, but once they have registered once, they're not a new registrant anymore, which means they're successive registrations, if they're happy with their first one, would then count as a recurring registrant, thus bringing that number down.
We would have to ask them, Olivier, did you have a domain name for the same purpose prior to 2012? So they would always base it off of, whenever we asked them the question, we could ask them to base it off of prior to 2012.
In which case, perfect, yeah. Okay, thanks.
And I think that we end up with saying that over time, we think that defensive registrations should decline over time, which is one way we can indicate our target. And we think that new registrants should increase over time without indicating a percentage. And I did want to repeat, people, that those aren't two sides of the same coin. Not all registrations are either defensive or new. There are going to be others where it's an attempt to get new traffic. JonathanZook.photo. It's hard to say that was defensive, to stop someone else from getting it. It's not new because he already had jonathanzook.com. It's an attempt to gain new traffic, and it may have a tiny bit of defensiveness to it, but there's a gray area there, so it's probably appropriate for us to have separate measures of new, as best as we can determine it through a survey, and defensive, which we hope to determine through redirect sampling.
Rosemary here, Steve. I just think to differ slightly. If Jonathan exercises the choice that's now been made available to be Jonathan.photo, then, you know, in some senses that is new. He may be doing it to increase traffic, but in the context of this program, he's exercising a choice to take a domain, to register a domain name when he didn't have that choice before.
Rosemary, we agree completely, but I'm saying that if Zook was one of the survey participants, he would say, no, I'm not a first-time registrant. I had one in the legacy TLDs.
Yeah.
And when we do a walk through the zone on redirect, he may well have redirected.
Yeah.
I'm saying that we have to do both. We have to measure new registrants, which are individual survey questions, and we have to measure redirects.
Yes.
And we do not want to conclude that a redirect is defensive.
No.
At all. So that's why I think we have to do both and not set percentages, but rather just talk about improvements, to your point. Over time, in the new space, defensive should go down, and over time, new registrants should go up as a percentage of total names in the zone.
Yes, I'm happy with that, Steve. That's good.
Barry, before we move on, why don't you put in the chat something that I thought was in reference to some earlier questions on transparency of registry restrictions. Did you have an answer for us you wanted to share?
Barry, no. I was just offering up comments with respect to the topic of defensive registration during the sunrise period, which is basically access to the zone files and those, that kind of nature. But I don't have a follow-up for the earlier question.
Do you think that what you discovered, though, does it get to Jonathan Robinson's idea that at the end of sunrise, we can ask ICANN staff as part of this measurement plan to examine and write down the number of names in the zone at the day the sunrise closed? And would that data be available?
Definitely the data should be available. As to whether ICANN would do it or a third-party provider, it's hard to say at this point. I don't believe ICANN does that today, but I can try to find out what they do with respect to zones and if they track or measure any activity going on within them.
Yeah, because you've indicated in your chat comment that the new guidebook requires a registry, or the registry contract, requires a registry to provide access to its zone file at some point before open registration. And the day of open registration is the same, for our purposes, is the same thing as the close of sunrise. So if that zone file is open on the first day of open registration, we would indicate there's no difficulty in getting access to the zone file to simply count how many rows are in it. The only difficulty is assigning an ICANN resource that would do that on that day, because if you missed the first day, you can't go back and get the old data unless we discover that there's archives being kept.
Correct. And I wouldn't shoestring ourselves that it may just be ICANN that can collect this. Perhaps there are providers out there that already do this or collect that data. So, let's just not narrow it down to just ICANN.
Okay, so if it weren't ICANN, it might be somebody like Spam House, Virtual Root, or companies that make a living collecting the data. But to be sure that they were there to collect it, ICANN may have to contract with them to go capture and catalog that data.
Correct.
Excellent. So that's the Robinson measure of sunrise to post-sunrise. We've got that recorded. Okay, we're doing well. We only have two more rows here under choice. We're on the second to last one, which is registrant choice among registrars and registries subject to differing national laws. This was suggested by Wendy and the NCUC, and it's an effort to say that registrants may want choices so they can pick a TLD that is in a country that will not allow WHOIS access, for instance, a country that protects privacy more so than other countries, and that that would be an example of choices so that people could pick a place that was very respectful of, say, privacy, and I might want to pick a place where the registry operator is subject to very strict laws from the banking industry. So I thought it was very novel, great suggestion on her part. Interested to get ideas from people about that and how we would measure it.
Stephen, this is John.
Go ahead.
So I think maybe Wendy is seeking to architect a solution to WHOIS that should be handled by the discussions about WHOIS. And I think it might be a little bit beyond the scope of what we're trying to do here.
And John Berard, in addition to that, I threw in my example, which is I may, as a registrant, want to pick a registry based in a really strong law and order country with a good court system, so that if the registry operator is screwing around and doesn't honor their promises, I can sue them, or I can count on law enforcement to crack down. So it might be broader than WHOIS, too.
Well, my point is that a bad actor is going to be a bad actor, and the metrics around consumer competition, choice, and trust, I don't know that, you know, I just don't know that we can establish a metric that would guard against the innovation of bad actors.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be the cause. We're not in the consumer trust category here. We're on the choice side. And you're right, bad actors will always choose where they can get away with it. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're left with a dilemma here. Wendy's not on the phone to sort of defend her idea, but she won't be away long. She'll be back. And I don't think we can delete this role. I do see some value in suggesting that having to choice among applicable national laws is a positive attribute. If every single new TLD was based in the United States, that wouldn't be a good thing. It'd be better that some were based in other countries offering registrants a choice of national laws. And,
Steve, it's Jonathan Robinson speaking. I think this could do with a little more clarification here. It's a matter of fleshing out what we actually mean here. And I think what I understood you to be saying and what seems to be the intended purpose here is that registrants have the opportunity to register amongst broadly equivalent TLDs in a jurisdiction of choice at the registry level, and ideally have a choice of registrars with whom to interact with that registry, again, so that they may choose their jurisdiction, whether that's for the purposes of freedom from restrictive practices of some sort or confidence in the legal system under which the registry or registrar is formed. So it just needs I could suggest some phrasing, but I suspect at the moment it's subject to quite a lot of interpretation. And really, I think it seems to be a very good idea that ultimately choice is reflected by the registrant having the option to register a domain name of choice in a jurisdiction of choice via a registrar of choice. But it doesn't come across, if that's what's meant.
It captured a very subtle point there, is that it has to be an applicable TLD. In other words, if I'm a general purpose, the .gay or .bank, I have to have multiple choices. That's extremely tough to measure. And we discussed and didn't pursue that, thinking that that would be very tough to do. But I would appreciate if you would put some of what the phrasing you just had into an email to all of this group. The chat's a bit small to do it in, so an email to this group where you try to rephrase this one to achieve that clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I do believe it's worth capturing, to say that registrants have choices to select registries and registrars whose have differing legal regimes.
Mm-hmm.
With that, and we can do that without implying it's about WHOIS. As John Berard indicated, that's really a third rail for us. We'd rather not touch that.
Yeah.
Because we don't want this to be some proxy for who is policy.
No.
What, assuming, Jonathan, we're able to rephrase it, how does one measure this? I guess it's a lawyer's survey of the nation of incorporation for every registry, and the same thing for every registrar. And we would measure the diversity before the new TLDs were launched, and then measure it in years 1, 2, and 3, and we'd like there to be more diversity in the new TLD space than there was in the pre-2012 space.
Yeah.
Is that enough, that it's more diverse? Or do you think Wendy would argue that everybody should have a choice of at least 2 national regimes for their applicable TLD?
Rosemary here. Steve, I don't think you can get to that point. You can only really get to the point that people have jurisdictional choice.
Mm-hmm.
And not requiring each jurisdiction, for example, to offer DocBank.
Right, but having at least 2 just says that before I pick my banking TLD, I'm going to look and say there's 3 of them out there. There's .finance, .bank, and .loan. They're all applicable for me. And it turns out they're all headquartered in the UK. Well, then I will fail Wendy's test.
Yeah.
I will fail our test. I will fail our test of diversity.
I agree.
It's an absolute way to measure to say that in any applicable TLD, there ought to be more than 1 choice. And I wouldn't make that an absolute requirement. And the other way is to just measure it relative to the existing TLD space today.
Yes, Rosemary, again, I'm just having trouble with the notion of a measure that forces market development. We need to just measure what the market is producing. And, for example, I might decide if my choices are .finance.uk versus .com, but for whatever reason, I just prefer to go with .com. So the choice is there for me, and I've exercised my choice, even if I go back to the existing world. So I'm happier with measuring what happens rather than incorporating a requirement of any sort into the measure.
Rosemary, here's the threshold question. I mean, I agree completely with you. This is only about measuring the goals for the new TLD expansion. It's never supposed to force market participants to do things they wouldn't have otherwise done.
Yes.
We are going to force ICANN to measure stuff that they wouldn't have otherwise measured.
Yeah.
But I don't believe we are going to put our finger on the scale of the market and tip it. We're endeavoring to see, did the new GTLD expansion deliver its promises?
Okay.
And one of the promises was consumer choice. So this is a measurement after the fact, in this case, of whether registrants had more or fewer choices. They're certainly going to have more choices than the pre-space. But will there be a greater diversity of national laws for applicable TLDs?
Okay, Steve. So the measure is whether there are more than, or whether there are 2 choices being offered in a particular jurisdiction.
Other way around. Whether there are at least 2 jurisdictions in which I can find a TLD that suits me.
Yeah.
Other way around. The challenge is what TLD suits me. If I'm looking for an e-commerce.
Yes.
TLD, then I might look at .shop and .buy. Let's say that 2 of those are launched. And if they're in different countries, then I have satisfied the choice metric.
Right.
I have satisfied. The new TLD program will have satisfied the metric without even trying. This was not something that could be engineered. It can only be observed after the fact.
But then someone is going to be making a decision that .bank, .finance, and .loan are the same thing. And
exactly. That's the dilemma. And Robinson brought that up earlier when he quoted the metric. It's extremely challenging to say what are suitable TLDs for a given applicant. This is a tremendously difficult thing to do if we add that layer of complexity. We could back up a step and just plain measure how many countries are the legal host to new TLDs. Let's say it's 75.
Yeah.
And compare that to what it is today, and Barry Cobb will help us by analyzing the 21 GTLDs we have today and find out that they're in 12 different national jurisdictions. So we went from 12 choices to 75 choices, and we'll check the box to say that there are more choices of national jurisdiction after the new GTLD program than there were before.
Woohoo!
I don't know that we would have expected any different answer to that. So that's the brute force way to do it.
Yep.
The ambitious way is to do it and only count them within applicable TLDs, suitable TLD classes.
Yeah.
What's the group think we should do?
Well, Rosemary here, for the purposes of the public comment phase, I think we should include the ambitious measure to see whether others in the community have a suggested way forward. I suppose my thinking about this piece of work that we're doing is that it will be a better piece of work for us taking the review plan through the complex thinking that you have to do when you're approaching the apparently simple task of measuring the effectiveness of the new G2LD program. So I opt to include it, even though it's very difficult, rather than just fall back to the simpler, easier measure without including any reference to this particular issue. Thank you. Other views on that?
Paul Redmond has his hand up.
And again, I can't see the hand, so thanks, Steve, for taking the baton on this one. Paul?
No, I mean, I guess it didn't lower from last time.
Oh.
Sorry.
Rosemary, your recommendation is to put both measures in here, the more suitable TLD measure of diversity of national law and the other one, which is just a total of all TLDs. And this may be the first row for which we need to add a footnote, because it might be a little small to jam some of this explanatory prose into these tables. So I can do that and see what the group thinks of that new draft. And Jonathan Robinson, you're going to send us new prose. And if you could please follow Rosemary's request and write two paragraphs, one that includes the measure for all TLDs as if they're all suitable, and then one that tries to cut it into subsets of suitable. Can I ask you to do that?
Sure.
Okay, there's one more on here. It's called the statistical measure of geographic diversity of registrants in new TLDs. And that would mean a scan of who is data to determine what country they're from. And we could compare it to the legacy TLDs if it can be done in an automated way. We have doubtful on this one, and Barry gave us that advice in terms of being able to get the data from who is. And we also have a doubtful because we're awaiting some wisdom on how one measures diversity. If there's a statistical measure of diversity that's used in the economics or demographic field. And I think Rosemary, you and Cheryl, others have been trying to get a handle on that.
Yes.
I'm sure that once we put this out for public comment, some brilliant soul in the ICANN community will provide us with a measure of statistical diversity. I guess a bigger challenge for us is, can we get the data?
Steve, Olivier has his hand.
Go ahead, Olivier.
Thanks, Steve. Olivier, for the transcript. The measure of diversity, geographic diversity, wouldn't this be to do with the percentage of registrants from various different countries? So you'd effectively have a percentage of registrants from country X and from Y and from Z, and finding out if countries which were relatively underrepresented as far as registrants are concerned are being, as a percentage of all registrations, being represented better than they were before. That said, the very fact that this would require Zone and Whois data is something which I agree would be very difficult to collect. Thank you.
Olivier, let me just respond real quickly. A measure of diversity is more absolute than that. It might be 0 to 1, where 0 diversity is that everybody's from the same country, and a perfect measure of 1 would be that every country is represented equally. And I'm unaware of the math necessary to do that, but that's what we were questing for, is some measure, a single measure of diversity. What you described was a little more targeted, where you pre-identified underrepresented areas and then tried to measure whether they improved their representation. And that's doable. That wasn't what we had captured here so far. We could enhance this measure to look at that. But let's turn to the issue of Whois data. Is it possible in the new TLDs with thick Whois, is it possible to walk the zones of thick Whois data and obtain the country of the registrant? And look to Barry and Jonathan and those of you who are closer to give us an answer.
This is Barry. I think that that's easier than some of the other metrics, especially with the thick Whois model, which is required. But just to carry on to this, I can visually see a statistical measure of geographic diversity among the types of registrants of any new GTLD. The question is how does that represent consumer choice? Because we're only depicting the statistic of the registrants and where they may be registering them, but does that really have anything to do with the choices that of TLDs that are presented to them?
Barry, this is Steve. You were sitting with me when Annalise Roger brought this up in Dakar, and let's try to remember what the rationale was. Maybe the minutes would have captured it, but I believe she was saying that if we observe that after the new GTLD program, there's greater diversity of where in the world registrants are coming from, then that would be showing that we produced choices for people in the new TTLB program that weren't there before. So presumably, the existence of IDN GTLDs will be a choice that wasn't available prior to 2012. And if people exercise that choice, we could measure it by an increased diversity of where registrants come from. That's my best recollection of what Annalise said.
Yes, I agree there. I think that is the intent. We haven't been able to confirm it, but that certainly was how I interpreted it at the time. That was Cheryl for the transcript record.
So it would be registrants are acting on
opportunity and choice.
Opportunity, thank you. Opportunity to register new names. Registrants from around the world acting opportunities to register.
And Cheryl, here for the record, Steve, that the usefulness of this is, for example, if in a whole lot of new GTLDs we have, even in IDNs, registrants who are predominantly claiming location in a geography which is akin to the legacy ones, in other words, predominantly Europe, North America, and we know where the hotspots are, we've got maps of that already, then that would presumably be a measure that indicated there was not an increased set of choices and opportunities, rather that the savvy pre-existing market are the ones who exploited the new GTLDs as opposed to new registrants coming into the market.
It doesn't necessarily indict the GTLD expansion program.
No.
It may be that those other parts of the world weren't really ready
it's
yet.
It's an observation because you've got accessibility issues, got all of those sort of things, and you'd then be able to look at measures between IDN and non-IDN spaces. So I think there's opportunity here for some interesting analysis.
Any other thoughts from the team? I will add a little more explanation in the column under measure, i.e. registrants acting on the opportunity to choose TLDs, new TLDs. I'll add a little color to the anticipated difficulties column, indicating that we believe that automated access to thick WHOIS data should be doable, but retaining the idea that it's, we still need a measure of geographic diversity. And that is the difficulty we'll acknowledge. Is everyone on board that the target is that the diversity should be greater than in legacy TLDs?
Yep.
Or should we also add over time, by year three, that diversity measure should be greater than it was in year one or something?
Rosemary here. I think we should add over time because, you know, it'll take a little while for people to really understand the opportunity and put their act together. So I don't think we should be worried if on day one we don't see this diversity, but we should be worried if by the end of year three we're not seeing it.
All right. Any other thoughts? Add that. And Barry, Olivier, and Cheryl are all discussing on the chat how privacy and proxy will completely defeat whatever we do in terms of walking thick WHOIS. So to the extent those are growing, we probably would disregard from our count privacy and proxy registrations. Everybody okay with that?
Happy to disregard, but I actually think it's an artifice that may be less of an issue. At the moment, the registrants in the world tend to come from the parts, geographically speaking, that have greater involvement, interest, insight and opinion on things like privacy and proxy. The couple of billion we're looking at to come, privacy is an anathema. Why would you use a proxy server? But yeah, happy to cull them.
I guess we should make that note wherever we talk about walking WHOIS data that privacy and proxy registrations will skew our count.
You have to cull those out of the data set.
All right, any other? I did have one new one to add to this table. I can't believe we've left it out, but our definition of choice includes options in domain scripts and languages. And we didn't actually, it was so obvious we didn't even put a row in for it. So I've got to add a row for that that says
you actually want to
and user choice
in,
among TLDs and different scripts and like. Duh.
Oops.
You radical, you fancy wanting to have multi scripting, I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. All right, are we everybody take a breath, take a break, and then we move to the last section? We have half an hour on our schedule.
Yeah.
Rosemary, it's in your hands.
Yeah, okay. So now, if I go back to... So we've completed all the measures.
Choice is done.
We've done it. So we've done competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice. And I thought it might be good, since we've got some new people on the call today, to just get their reaction to the earlier part.
No, we've got to do measures of competition, Rosemary. Sorry, Cheryl here.
Sorry, Cheryl. You're right. Measures of competition. Okay, so we're back on that page because we've done some measures on the way through. So sorry about that. Okay, so as we do this, then perhaps if there are any comments from new people on the call about the measures, then we can take that as we go. Sorry, I'm confusing myself. Caffeine problem. Okay, so would you mind, Steve, leading us through this?
Great. The measures of competition, which are on page 9, and again, we have the competition is defined as the quantity, diversity, and the potential for market rivalry. GTLDs, TLD registry operators, and registrars. It does occur to me that today a lot of CCTLDs have taken on G characteristics.
Yep.
Yeah, .co, for example. And given that, it's entirely possible that our definition ought not have the GTLD, but only TLDs, because there's market rivalry among all TLDs TLD registry operators and registrars without respect to whether they're G or CC. What's everybody think of that? Dropping the G from the definition.
I can see why we want to do this. I think we still should have a measure of GTLDs, even if we do the whole market measure of TLDs. Cheryl?
Yeah, I'm again. I think I'd rather go belts and braces and just prune it to TLDs. For my major reason, and believe me, as a board member of an operator of a CCTLD, yeah, I would see us in competition with GTLDs all the time. Our market edge is very much, you know, we market against GTLDs in our country actively and successfully. But so yeah, I think that's definitely the rivalry is there, and we perhaps could measure it. But our mandate in and what the affirmation of commitment asked for was all about GTLDs. So I'd certainly not want to remove GTLD from that definition, Steve, if you want to just put in GTLDs, TLDs and TLD operators and registrars, then belts and braces works for me, but I'd rather not change it than prune it out from the G space.
Yep.
Okay, so if we dive into the actual measures, the first four are relatively straightforward. They're just the quantities of before and after expansion. Mm-hmm. And everybody expects this to go up. Naturally, we'll have more TLDs. We'll have more unique operators, both for registries and registrars, more back-end service providers. So the question would be, should we set a target, an increase of X percent? Because it seems lame to simply say an increase, since everyone knows by definition we'll get an increase.
Can I ask Barry, Cheryl here for the record, can I ask Barry, is there any talk around the hallways of what the utopia is in terms of ICANN terms? Are we sitting around dreaming of 30% in 3 years or 300% in 3 years? Just a scale of measure, not an actual measure, is what I'm after.
Barry, I'm not aware of any hallway talk like that. I don't know.
Okay.
If I were to, you know, take a look at this, personally, I think quantity of GTLDs before and after expansion really has to do with, how many of them are still in operation after a given time frame. I'm not necessarily sure if that's, it is an end result of competition that if a registry provider opens up their new shop with their new TLD and fails 6 months later, and we start off with hypothetically 100 new TLDs, and after 1 year only 50 of them still exist, isn't that a function of competition and that they weren't able to compete? But in terms of just a strict number of, we start with 21 that we have today and we're going to move to 100 tomorrow and then 200 TLDs in 3 years, is that really a statement of competition rather than just plain expansion?
Good explanation, Barry. Would that be food for thought where we would consider dropping this first measure, or does it argue for a particular kind of a target, Barry?
Could I ask Tobias's opinion on that? Because I'm a little too naive on the wonderful world of how markets measure competition. I'm suspecting that it's actually arguing for a measure, but I'd like some real expertise in advice.
Well, this is Tobias. I'm not sure if I can offer this expertise, but at least perhaps there are two different notions of competition, and one would be the new entrants are somehow competing on the same market. So by just counting them, you could say, oh, there is a lot of competition.
Okay.
So that's basically one notion of competition. And I'm always a bit unsure about whether this is the notion of competition this group wants to capture or whether it's something else. But at least as we define it now, competition is defined as the quantity and so on of GTLDs, then the answer would be yes. There is a second notion of competition, which is, at least in the European regulatory framework, often called effective competition. That looks at the market structure. So, for example, if you have a complete monopoly, only one supplier, then you would definitely have not effective competition. And at least in the telecoms market in Europe, one would agree that with a market share of 40% or so, there is a dominant actor, then the European Commission would not define that as effective competition. So that means in the European regulatory framework that certain particular rules apply. It's lawful to be a dominant actor, but that just means that the market is structured in a particular way where it is not in effective competition. Does that help?
It does, Cheryl, here for the Transcript Record. It does greatly, because it helped me think that what we also need to do is not just collect this raw number data, but also collect the raw number data and then purpose an analysis between likely purposed GTLDs. It also means that we need to have a parallel measure of what is effective competition as defined in different market sectors, because sitting with my Asia Pacific hat on, as opposed to your European hat on, the aversion to monopoly is vastly different, for example, in some of the sovereign states and territories that I work with. And, of course, having the opportunity for even a monopoly operator in some countries and sectors that are, for example, in an IDN scripted world, only just becoming accessible to end users, consumers, and even having access to the internet is a current issue for some of the space. I would still see even a monopoly operator as an increase in opportunity, but clearly an opportunity for competition. And where it is measured at day one versus year three is going to be the variable that we'd be looking at.
Well, just to follow up briefly on that, I think there is an interesting historical parallel, at least with the telecoms market in Europe. Previously, there were monopolies, national monopolies, and then that was opened up. So new entrants were able to come into the market and provide telecom services.
Yep.
And what one found out then around 2002 or 2003 was that the regime that was implemented allowing new market entrants did not change that much because of the dominance of the previous monopolies. So that led then to a new regulatory regime where the main goal was no longer just establish competition, let new market entrants into the market, but also to somehow regulate the market in order to improve a situation that was perceived as not absolutely perfect, where there was too much dominance. Thanks.
So, Rosemary here. It seems to me, taking account of all that background discussion, we do need a simple measure around quantity before and after, because that's at least the start point. Have new entrants into the market. The more difficult and longer term measure is whether those new entrants are providing effective competition. And it seems that's where we go back to Tobias' point about the process of rivalry. So perhaps for the first 3 years, like with the telco sector, for the first 5 or 10 years, when new entrants came into the market, people were satisfied to measure the number of, and in that market, it's new licenses or new carriers. So here it would be new GTLDs, but reserving somehow or making the point that it would be necessary over time to ensure that those new entrants were in fact exercising some power in the market and making the market more competitive. Remembering, of course, that in this analysis that we're doing, unlike most telco regulatory analysis that I've seen, we're actually suggesting measures on the consumer side. So we're not measuring competition alone in a market share, number of licenses, whatever, as the economists usually do. But we've actually got some specific measures about consumer choice. And perhaps the combination of those measures, quantity of new entrants on the one side and exercise of consumer choice, provides us with good knowledge of this field. So I'm not sure, Steve, where that takes us in terms of rows and measures, but I suppose to come down for me, I think quantity of entrants in this competition box combined with exercise of choice in our consumer choice box is a good enough balance.
This is Steve. I'll only contribute. I'm learning a lot from the discussion, and I know that with Tobias we have an expert here. This is the area where we've spent the least amount of time scrutinizing our measures. And the one thing we've said about it is that we're all very uncomfortable about pricing, which is at the bottom half of this table, both the ability to obtain prices and the implication that lower prices give you better value. They may not. It may be a higher price is well worth it in a special purpose TLD.
Yes.
So we haven't even got into the pricing. We're up on what we thought were the easiest rows of all, the quantities. And we haven't even dove into the center section, which was the new entrance.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at a loss as to where to go with this next. I thought perhaps we would have a quick consensus on the quantity measures.
Yeah.
But why don't we see if we can get some, before we all run out of gas here, can we get some kind of a conclusion on the four quantity rows?
Okay. Rosemary here, the quantity of GTLDs before and after expansion, I think we should keep the row, and I think we can only really shoot for an increase. I don't think we can say an increase of 10% or 30%. It might be that the review team has other sources of data and can go there, but I don't think we can. Pardon me. So we've got the suggestion.
Rosemary, let me just suggest that if we don't put any target, it feels embarrassing to me because it's self-evident.
Yeah,
we know we'll have new TLDs. And I can just see community members weighing in, saying, what were we thinking?
Okay.
I agree with you, Steve. Cheryl Heath, the record. I think there's a reason to put a target of a percentage. Even if it's, we do recognise it's a target, the investment, in inverted commas, on this process would be listed in the annals of history as farcical if we were looking at a 10, 15, 20 or even 30% over 3 years from our 21 existing at the moment. The order of magnitude needs to be significantly higher if this is to be measured as meaningful and successful expansion.
Uh-huh. Okay, so any other views on the call about that?
This is Barry. How about not listing a target per se, but stating that, you know, these quantity metrics are a base to the overall metrics that we're trying to attain across the three definitions? You know, many of these metrics on all three of them will require some function or another that we do know what the current quantity of registry operators are, the current quantity of registrars are. But to put just necessarily a target on there for the sake of putting one, I'm not sure buys us anything. Because from what I heard from Tobias, it sounds like, you know, if they're just the quantity of entrants by themselves isn't necessarily an indication of competition. So that we don't necessarily keep it blank, we just state there isn't really a target yet to be defined, but they are a base metric for us to use across all the other metrics, if that made sense.
It makes sense, Barry. Cheryl here for the transcript record, and I'm happy to have it subsected out like that if needs be, and it might be that there is a significant need to do that. The other way, or perhaps as well as, if we were to put in a target, and I'm really nervous here in terms of, that's why I was hoping for some sort of order of magnitude feedback. It's a bit like looking at a business plan and measuring it. That if we could use terms which are admittedly soft terms like significant increase, but then fall back on statistically what is significant when we do the measure, that would make me feel a bit better.
You'd say at least doubling, but doubling doesn't feel anywhere close to an order of magnitude of,
yeah,
200 TLD.
Mm.
You know, if you include the CCs in the space, things like .co, et cetera, are all very readily substitutable for things like com. Is it possible that this is the quantity of TLDs total before and after? And if you did that with a couple of hundred CCs,
that,
it doesn't change the whole number system a little bit. We're not looking
could,
at 21 as the base. We're looking at more like 270 as the base.
That could work. You know, that could work very well, Steve.
And yet, if we're unable to set a target, and we already know they're going to meet an increase, I would end up arguing against deleting the row rather than keeping it in a way that's either self-evident or too vague. That's why I'm pushing for the specificity rather than vagueness.
So, Big Rosemary here, just how specific did you suggest we should get?
On the assumption that it's total TLDs, and we're at roughly 300, I would say that doubling in the number of total TLDs, including CCs.
That works.
100% increase. If instead our base was 21, then I would say we want an order of magnitude, which goes from 21 to the order of 200. Two different ways to skin that cat, right?
Yeah, and to be honest, I'm more comfortable bringing it down to out to TLDs as opposed to narrowing it to GTLDs on this, because it allows us the opportunity to capture that very important aspect of market opportunity competition from a consumer endpoint perspective, and the rivalry that does exist between some CCTLDs and the legacy TLDs we know about in the G space, but undoubtedly will increase in the expanded marketplace.
So this is John. Steve, Cheryl, how do we handle things like .tv, .la, .co?
This
we can't ignore the CC space.
But that's what I'm saying. By putting it as TLDs, as Steve suggests, means we are not ignoring it. We are capturing it, and deliberately so.
Excellent.
Okay, so Rosemary here, if we do that, I think we will have to put a footnote in explaining why we're doing that, because everything else up until this point has been very focused on GTLDs.
But I think that's going to actually, Cheryl, here for the record, do a very good thing if we footnote that, and also if we make sure we highlight that in our presentations in Costa Rica, is because certainly in the community that Olivier and I represent on this work team, the discussion on aspects of CCTLDs versus GTLDs in terms of competition and choice is already going on. So
Steve, earlier in the call, I dropped it when it didn't seem like there was consensus, but earlier in the call I suggested we actually change the definition to drop the G for just this particular measure for the same reasons that folks are discussing right now. So I hope we'll be able to come back to that at some point. I'll park it as a footnote as well. That could be where we discuss this, is up in the definition section, where we define competition, we clarify that this expansion needs to create competition amongst back-end providers, registrars, registries, and TLDs that compete for the space. And today, that competition crosses from the G into the C space and back again. That the total TLD space is the universe of competition, not just the G subset.
If we expand it up there at the very beginning, then that's fine. It was just dropping it from title only that I wasn't happy with. I was happy to add in CCTLDs or all TTLDs, but not just to delete G.
Great. Okay. Fantastic. Then I'll make a proposed language to explain that up in the definition section, and if everybody's cool with it, it would just simply carry down to here.
Rosemary, I think it's much better to have it up in the definition section rather than in a footnote somewhere. We're almost 5 to 9 my time. Could I just draw out, Barry's been in the chat making all sorts of points. Barry, would you mind just sharing your thoughts with the group?
Yes, Rosemary, this is Barry. I keep referring back to our definition of competition, and it's ultimately about just the service providers of this market. And while we're focusing in on the quantities of these, ultimately it's about whether they succeed or fail is the true gauge to competition. And again, Tobias, please back me up with more expertise, but. So it just makes me wonder about the targets. In a perfect state, we wouldn't want any of these providers to fail, absent of plan consolidation or acquisition. But, in the community, many think several will fail. Looking over time that, it would be a declining percentage of failures or something along those lines.
Right.
Barry, as a new measure, Cheryl here.
Please go ahead.
Would that be as a new measure?
No, I'm really just focusing in on the targets. I mean, I still agree. I mean, all the four of these quantity measures are valuable measures, as I mentioned before, in terms of baselining all the other metrics.
Mm-hmm.
But just purely as a function of whether these service providers succeed or fail is, to me, the defining moment of measuring competition within this space.
Cheryl here again. That's the rationale for why I thought it would be a new line. Sorry, my birds are going berserk because there's birds of prey going over. Because it would be a new line in the table to measure 3 years out the sustainability of the GTLDs.
Rosemary here and Tobias might want to make a comment. I'm not aware in the other market analysis of people looking at failures as either a measure of effective or ineffective competition. That's what happens in a market. And perhaps particularly a market that's working effectively. I'm thinking is that it's taking us to a subset of measures about the market, which is possibly too focused for our purpose, which is evaluating this big initiative. Having said that, if we were to have a series of measures that indicated there was no increase in the number of VGLD operators over time, once we started to explore that, we could see that that perhaps is because some are exiting the market and some are coming into the market. But that looks to me like a healthy market, people coming in and out. So a measure which says we don't ever want anyone to fail is not, I think, a realistic measure. Well, I'm just uncomfortable about the degree of specificity that we're getting to in this suggestion by Barry. And having said that, we've got about 3 minutes left on this call, and I think we're still on number one in the quantity section, am I right?
Well, 1 to 4. Being bundled.
So obviously we need to finish this work before we put this document out for public comment. So
next
I
meeting.
Think I'm just giggling at Barry's last comment in the chat. Sorry, everybody. So we need to talk about next meeting, yeah. And I guess the way we've been doing that in the past is for Barry and Natalie, the team, to send out a doodle poll pretty quickly and for us all to respond, but within the order of a week or so. Are there any comments on that approach?
Can we meet again next week and try and finish this table off? Because if we do that, then we're not shifting our schedule out.
Yes, I'm happy to do that, Cheryl. I guess that's what I was flagging a bit inarticulately to everybody else. Is everybody okay for me to again next week finish this table?
Yes.
Okay, same time, same space. Works for me.
And thanks to everybody who commented in writing over the past several days. That was really helpful to stimulate the discussion.
Okay. Barry, would you or Natalie mind just confirming with a doodle poll, same time, same place, et cetera? And once again, my apologies to everybody. Because I'm travelling, I'm using the mobile version of Adobe Connect and I can never see the hands. So if the conversation has been a bit all over the place, I apologise for that, but I think it's been a very good conversation nonetheless.
Hear, hear.
I'll try to turn around a V5 in the next 24 hours.
Okay. Yep. Thanks,
Thanks, Steve. It's been really good. I think we're getting there, though, mate.
Good.
True.
I think so too.
Great.
Cheers,
everyone.
Thank you. And
thanks,
Rosemary,
everyone.
We'll get out the doodle and get the next call scheduled for next Tuesday. So thank you, everyone, too.
All right. Thanks so much for that. Bye, everybody.
Bye.